Recently, I ordered a shipment from Critic in a Box. You send them information about yourself, and they ship you a specifically selected critic, so let's see what I got.
Chili for breakfast. Ms. Wolf may fancy herself a chili and cilantro-infused holly-go-lightly, but this critic thought the dish tasted like newsprint and was salted so meekly that eating it was as satisfying as waving a white flag while the Ostrogoths sacked one's small village.
Wow, that really hurts. Anyway, I gotta get ready for work.
As she picked out her clothes, many of Ms. Wolf's outfits looked over-designed, with tabs and bits added to shoulders and panels attached to knees, or drastically under-designed, drab hoodies, baggy pants, and beige underthings.
Hey, cut it out. I already see where this is going. You sit there on the sidelines, one of the kids who's afraid to ask anybody to dance, but totally willing to make fun of how the rest of the kids move out on the floor.
And yet, there were times when Ms. Wolf showed flashes of authenticity and eloquence. This critic enjoyed her speech denouncing the Sartrean labyrinth into which she had paradoxically plunged herself.
That's better. Come on, we gotta get going. I cannot be late.
At other times, the pace felt unnecessarily rushed. This critic thought...
Shut up!
Story of my life. People only want the good reviews.
Today on the show, is criticism art? And now, one critic wrote, his shows are like buying scalp tickets to see Leontine Price at the Met, only to find out she's singing the Katy Perry songbook while roller skating backwards with a cantaloupe balanced on her neck. Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, I had a hard time understanding that particular review. It actually would be something I would buy a ticket to, but it seemed like maybe the critic wouldn't. So when my son was, quick story here, I figured out today, 11 years old, he and I went to see him a movie called A Knight's Tale with Heath Ledger. And I just happened to love it in a kind of a brainless way. And we walked out of it, and my son, who could read my body language very well, said, "You really liked that movie, didn't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You really liked it, right?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You didn't feel like there were people who were not correctly cast in the movie?" I said, No. He goes, "You didn't think there were ideas or themes that they could have worked on a little bit better, developed a little bit more?" I said, "No, is that what it's like to go see a movie with me?" And he said, "Yeah, pretty much, actually." And that's sort of the curse of critical engagement, right? That there are an awful lot of people who can just sort of go through life, kind of like Thomas Hayden Church in the movie Sideways, if you recall. It's kind of it's a wine movie, but it's really about criticism and connoisseurship. You know, Paul Giamatti is constantly smelling flutterings of Edom and stuff like that in wine, and Thomas Hayden Church is this guy who goes, "Well, it tasted pretty good. I thought that tasted pretty good," or "I don't like that so much," which is kind of how a lot of people live their lives. On the other hand, there's this whole class, this priesthood of critics who invite us to engage more, to think more, to dwell more with art, and maybe even to be affected or changed by art. So that's the conversation we're about to have today. What are critics for? And to join us, we have an all-star panel. We have A.O. Scott, who's been on our show many times before, and he is the co-chief film critic for the New York Times and the author of Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. Michael Riedel is with us, theater columnist for the New York Post, and the co-host with Susan Haskins of Theater Talk, and the author of Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway. And also making a return to the show, Carrie Rickey, film critic and writer and former film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, among many other places. So, where to begin? Well, Tony Scott, I'm going to ask you to sort of kick us off since this is your book. Who did you write this book for? Did you write this book for consumers of criticism and therefore of art? Did you write it for those people who get reviewed by critics? Did you write it as kind of a pep talk to your fellow critics? I suppose the answer is going to be all of the above.
I primarily wrote it in a way for myself, just to figure out what I thought. I'd been doing this job for a while, and every now and then I would read an article about how critics were useless, or somebody would come up to me at a party and say, "What is it you do exactly? How is that even a job?" So I started out thinking, well, I would justify myself to myself and defend myself against all of the critics of criticism out there, but it shifted over time, and I got less interested in a way in defending my own professional prerogatives or the guild that I'm part of, and more thinking about what criticism is as an ordinary everyday activity. How can it describe and how can it influence the way that we think about entertainment and works of art? So it's pitched much more at not at my fellow professionals who are reviewing it anyway and finding all kinds of interesting things to say about it, but at people who like movies, who maybe read criticism or who maybe don't.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that later because obviously this is a work of meta-criticism and the reviews of it are therefore meta-meta-criticism. And I've even seen one piece of meta-meta-meta-criticism, somebody reviewing Leon Wieseltier's book of your, review of your book. So there's a lot of layers here. It'll take us forever to get our noses out of our navels here. Michael Riedel.
yes.
So this one of the things we hear now is that this priesthood is somewhat imperiled, you know, that there aren't as many newspapers. Newspapers are where critics live. That on the other hand, there's the rise of the dangerous amateur. That somehow or other, whatever this job is, it's a ticking time bomb of a job. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, I want to say, along with Tony, this is my first book, so I'm having the experience of the shoe on the other foot. And what I've learned about critics is that if they like your book, they're brilliant. If they don't, they're complete idiots. I think that holds true from anybody who's been reviewed by a critic. But the job is imperiled now. I think in many ways, Tony's fine book should give a boost to the spirits of a lot of my friends who are drama critics who are living in terror now of being laid off and losing their jobs at newspapers. And I think Tony makes the good case that criticism still is relevant and perhaps may be even more relevant in the age of what you referred to as the amateur critic. I don't like to look down my nose at people who go onto websites and internet chat rooms and have valid opinions about shows. But there is a lot of noise out there, and I do think there is room for someone like Tony or like myself in the theater world who've spent big chunk of our lives going to movies, going to plays, and thinking about them, and having created some of our own values with which to back up our judgments about the art form that we cover.
So, Kerry Rickey, Tony Scott makes the argument that criticism is not only symbiotic with art, but may even be an art in and of itself, maybe a later born child in the same family tree of art, but also art. What do you make of that argument?
I think that in some cases it can be. In all cases, no. I think it's very hard to make an argument that, let's say, The Avengers is art. And I would put it in a different class of movie than I would put the Big Short or Selma or, you know, to name two. But, yes, I think we know some criticism is art. I mean, we've read Pauline Kael. We've read many critics whose work is lyrical and fascinating and challenges us.
So let's get to the thing that Kerry just cited, because to me it's one of the really interesting battlegrounds for criticism, which is how first of all, I should say that one of the many things that I have been an abject failure at, for a brief time, I was probably the worst rock critic in America. And one of the reasons I was a terrible rock critic is I really had a hard time evaluating something on its own terms, what it was trying to do, what it was trying to be. You know, I would go and I would see Fleetwood Mac in the Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham era, and I would say, God, this is terrible and self-indulgent and referential, and why isn't it The Birds? The Birds were really good. This is horrible. But I wasn't really, and this was true in case after case, I wasn't really necessarily engaging with the art in terms of what it set out to do, what it set out to be. And so, Tony Scott, this is a question, right? Is do you have platonic standards against which you measure everything, or do you at some point have to make a decision to sort of say, all right, well, this is what this thing is trying to do, and I can only judge it that far. I can't compare it to Strindberg.
I don't think that there are kind of absolute external standards of excellence. I think that there are standards of excellence that we are always creating, that we are always arguing about, that are part of the very work of criticism and of culture and of art is to figure out what those standards are and how to apply them. I think it is important to have a sense of proportion, certainly to figure out you know, what a film is trying to be, and to measure it in those terms. It makes no sense, you know, to compare an apple and an orange, to, you know, to say, well, you know, Zoolander 2 falls short of the standard of Citizen Kane, you know, because you're not saying anything that's useful or meaningful. But you also have to take into account, and I think this is the, in a way, one of the most difficult but also one of the most worthwhile things about criticism, is that you have your own experience. The thing that you know for sure about what you saw is what you thought of it and how it felt to you and what that experience was like of sitting in that theater, watching that play, watching that movie. And you have to somehow translate your own feeling, your own kind of visceral or emotional response, your own reflex that you liked it or that you hated it or that you were bored. You have to turn that into an argument. You have to turn that into something that's going to be useful and interesting to somebody else. And that is the key turn that I think makes criticism at very least a craft, if not always an art. How to organize those thoughts, how to pass that information on in a form that will be persuasive or at least provocative for other people.
And engaging. I mean, I think the first and foremost, the job of the critic is to be an entertaining and an engaging writer, because very often you're going to be reviewing a movie or a play that many people reading you are never going to see. But what you want to do is hold their interest as an essayist, as a good journalist, as a good reporter. And I do think the best critics have a reportorial side to them, that they will convey to you what it felt like to sit in that theater last night to watch Lin-Manuel Miranda do Hamilton. And indeed, the value of criticism before the video age was that it's the only record that we have in the theater of Shakespeare's plays, of Ibsen's early plays. It's the critics who saw those, who captured great performances lost to the ages, great plays. The experience of seeing something new and exciting in the art form will be forever captured by the critic who was there.
You know, that, Gary, that historical piece is interesting. And I think also it's a struggle a little bit for the critic. A lot of times when new art forms come along, and sometimes they even are implicitly a rejection of craft in the way that the critic has previously understood it. I think of punk. I think to a certain degree of Dada. You know, these are movements that come along to say, you know what, everything that you think about how you evaluate stuff, we're going to throw that out and do something else. And the challenge for the critic is to see it now and maybe anticipate the way it will even look 25 years down the road, where it's seen as a movement as opposed to people playing their guitars really loudly and not all that well. Oh, yeah, Gary, I was wondering, I was inviting you to react to that one.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't hear my name recited. Forgive me. Absolutely. I think the French New Wave was like that. You don't have jump cuts. You shouldn't do that. You don't, you know, you shouldn't be flippant in a drama about murder, but the French New Wave was all those things, and and it was very exciting to many people, and it was a huge challenge to what the French called the tradition of quality in French cinema, but not everyone embraced it. It was, you know, perceived as a threat, and now, you know, in the last few years, you know, digital cinema was considered a threat to film itself, and it's important to kind of be aware of the new, but not be wary of it, and to, you know, see, test your reaction. And I don't know about the gentleman on this in this colloquy, but I certainly feel that when I sit down to write, I am a medium for this movie or book or song or artwork, and, you know, it kind of passes through me, and I record my response to it, and I try to write about it in the tone it was delivered.
Well, there's so many ways to go here, so many places we could branch off. Well, let's talk about what Carrie just said, and I'll throw it back to Tony and to Michael. So Carrie says a medium, although you're not always a medium through which something flows, right? Sometimes, to use somebody else's, what?
Sometimes it gets caught in my craw.
That's exactly where I was going to go. Sometimes you're a hammer or a cudgel or something like that. Sometimes you're saying, no, it's my job to say this is meretricious, don't be fooled by this. Don't waste your time on this, or do waste your time on this, but certainly have your sensors, your antennae up. So, Tony, this is something you treat of in your book, the whole question of the bad review and also the trend that was documented a few years ago in book reviewing of avoiding bad reviews, of good reviews only. So let's talk a little bit about the role of the pan, the role of the takedown. How do you see that, Tony?
I see it a few different ways. I mean, I think that it's very important. One of the functions that we serve as critics is to be independent and honest and unbought voices. When you're writing about movies or certainly about Broadway in New York City, you're writing about very big industries, very, very heavily capitalized art forms, and that have enormous resources of marketing and publicity and hype at their disposal, and they can place all kinds of lovely soft features in newspapers and magazines, and the stars will go out on the talk shows, and they will create an enormous sense of anticipation. And it's not necessarily our job to tear that down all of the time, but it is our job to approach it with some skepticism and to talk about it honestly, and to risk sometimes being out of touch with where the audience seems to be going, and certainly what the makers of and distributors and producers of these things would want us to go. So, I think it's I don't think it's always appropriate. I mean, I try not to be too cruel, too sadistic, although it can be a lot of fun, you know, to beat up on something. And it is a chance when you're writing. One of the guilty pleasures, one of the maybe the vices of criticism, is the funny negative review. It's a lot easier to make jokes and to feel like you're a clever, witty writer when you're tearing something down. But I think it's important in the end to be honest and to be tough, and that's the way that you defend over the long term the chance for the art to be as good as it can be. I think that when you pull your punches, if you're too soft, this goes to what you're saying about what's often said about book reviewing or other kinds of reviewing. Well, that we have to be, you know, we have to support these art forms are in danger. You know, independent film or various forms of theater need our protection, need to be kind of nurtured and coddled. And I think that's a very dangerous idea. I think it's because audiences will always go, and they will not be fooled. And if you're part of fooling them, then you have failed at your job.
Yes, then you're a booster. And I think there's nothing more detrimental to a critic who becomes a consistent champion of something or an artist all the time. And even when that artist does a bad job, you still pull your punches because the audience is not. They will go and they will cease to trust you and your voice and your judgment if you let them down. Now, Tony used the word tough, and I think we do have to be tough. I do think there's a little bit of a gleeful sadism in all of us who do this. And it's fun. Listen, it's fun, as Tony says, to write a bad review. And frankly, the meaner I have been in my career, the more money my employers have paid me. So there's a practical side to that as well. But I do think that there's something constructive, if you will, in destructive criticism. Artful criticism can be written about something that is terrible. And I think of George Bernard Shaw when he was a critic. And the leading playwright of his day was a guy named Sardou, who wrote silly melodramas. And Shaw demolished those melodramas and in so doing started to make the case for the realistic dramatic theater of Ibsen. So in the destruction of something, he was also trying to create something. And I think that's when tough, almost thuggish criticism can be beneficial to the art form.
Michael, I want to stay with you on this for just a second, too, and say you're in a slightly different position than Tony and Carrie, that it is a slightly more precarious situation. There aren't, first of all, as many plays. They are precariously financed. Certainly in his day, Frank Rich was called the butcher of Broadway. There's often been a sense that in New York, a bad New York Times review can shut a show down. I don't know whether you feel as though you have that power or not, but certainly people's livelihoods are hanging in the balance sometimes based on what you say. That, you know, on the other hand, if that's the kind of thing that bothers you, it could be argued you're in the wrong line of work.
No, it doesn't bother me at all. I mean, the Times always had the bazooka, and Frank could kill the show with one bad review. I, working in tabloid newspapers at the New York Post with a weekly column, I kill through the steady drip, drip, drip of the Chinese water torture, because I can go back week in and week out and mock and ridicule poor old Julie Taymor and Spider-Man or whatever. So, and that's fun. You know, and I'm not a critic in the traditional sense. I'm a commentator on the theater. I combine the news and the gossip and the backstage feuds, and I'm, as a columnist, I can take sides. I can promote someone. I can go after someone. I can go after a show. Clearly, my column is opinionated. But I believe in the rough and tumble of the Broadway world. I believe in Addison DeWitt and All About Eve. I believe in getting into the intrigue. I don't want to say that I'm policing people or trying to keep them honest. But as Tony said earlier, and it is true, the Broadway people I cover are extraordinarily rich. And they have many means of marketing their shows at their disposal to run around critics, to overcome critics. I do feel that it's good to have somebody like me just sitting on the sidelines, skeptically snickering from time to time at their hopes and their dreams.
All right. So last year in a movie, we saw some of that attitude made perhaps a little chillier and more toxic in the form of Lindsay Duncan playing a critic in Birdman. Let's hear a little bit of her and Michael Keaton.
Well, you know, what has to happen in a person's life for them to become a critic anyway?
What are you writing, another review? Is it any good? Is it? Is it bad? Did you even see this? Let me read it.
I will call the police.
Let me call the police. Let's read you. Callow's a label. Lackluster. That's just the labels. Marginality. Are you kidding me? It sounds like you need penicillin to clear that up. That's a label too. These are just all labels. You just label everything. That's so lazy. You're a lazy. Do you know what this is? Do you even know what that is? You don't. You know why? Because you can't see this thing if you don't know how to label it. You mistake all those little noises in your head for true knowledge.
Are you finished?
No, I'm not finished. There's nothing in here about technique. There's nothing in here about structure. Nothing in here about intention. It's just a bunch of crappy opinions backed up by even crappier comparisons. You write a couple of paragraphs. And you know what? None of this costs you anything. You risk nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. I'm a actor.
So there's a little bit more of Michael Keaton in there than I had hoped for, and a little less of Lindsay Duncan, because what she says, and Carrie, I'm sure you're...
I will destroy you.
Yeah, she says, I will shut your play down. But she also says, look, you're a celebrity. I'm kind of a gatekeeper in between the world that you come from and the world that you now want to inhabit. That's my job. I mean, she says it in this incredibly punishing and rejecting way. But she's sort of making the point, Carrie, I'm asking you, but she's making the point that Michael sort of said before. This is a rough and tumble world. You want to get in here. You think the fact that you're famous in Hollywood and that you used to be a superhero on film is good enough. Well, it's not good enough for me. And I feel as though part of my job is to defend this territory against imposters. How did you react to that scene?
Well, I think a part of that scene, she basically tells Michael Keaton she will destroy him, which I don't think you say that before you seen a work.
True, true.
I believe that all of us here walk in to a play or a movie with neutral or with high hopes, I would hope, and not prejudge. But I don't like the word gatekeeper, but I do feel that I am here to warn people not to waste several hours of their life if something is a piece of drac.
All right, we have to grab a quick break here. We'll be back with more of all three guests and a conversation about criticism after this.
Danger, I mean, why wait around? It's just to surrender. An ambition I found can lead only to failure. I do not read the reviews. No, I am not.
Ah. Woo. Oh dear.
neither pastoral nor lyrical.
You don't suppose that it's satirical?
Hmm? Oh, just density without intensity.
No life. Boys with their clothes on.
I must paint a factory next.
All right, the sound of critical voices in Sunday in the Park with George. So our guest right now is include Michael Riedel, a theater columnist for the New York Times and co-host with Susan Haskins of Theater Talk, author of Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, A.O. Scott, co-chief film critic for the New York Times and the author of Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth, and Carrie Rickey, film critic and writer and former film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. So I want to ask all of you, and I think, Tony, I'll start with you on this. Okay, so for most people, and for most people who read criticism and who think critically about movies, there's, I think, ticking away like a little bomb in the back of their heads, this notion that there really is sort of objectivity, or that some things are objectively good, some things are objectively bad. It isn't really a conversation. That, like, for example, I think Hail Caesar, even though I'm a big Coen Brothers fan, I think it's a bad movie. I think it's an objectively bad movie. I'm not really interested in somebody else's argument that it's a good movie. I feel as though somehow or other I could prove that it's a bad movie. I could summon a set of aesthetic standards and arguments and say, no, this proves it's a bad movie. But I'm wondering whether a critic can ever think that, that once again, that there's some kind of platonic standards to which anything can be compared and really accurately measured.
Well, I mean, I think objectivity is always, you know, kind of a bit of a briar patch, and I think that it kind of gets us into all kinds of philosophical questions that that we're maybe not at least I'm not equipped to adjudicate. And I spend some time on this in the book, just even the question of sort of what are we talking about? Are we talking about properties of the thing that we're writing about, or are we talking about the experience that we have? And I guess, I mean, yes, you could do that with Hail Caesar, and someone else could have an equally persuasive, equally well-documented, equally coherently argued case, you know, for it being a great movie. And a lot of people might fall somewhere in the middle. I think it's much more about persuasiveness than it is about objectivity. It's about the case that you're making, kind of in the court of public discourse, in the world of print and of media, which is always an argumentative world. And I don't think that these questions ever really get settled. I think when they do, when a consensus is reached, is in a way when a kind of pall falls over the work of art and it stops being interesting. I think as long as something can be argued about, as long as somebody can cast doubt on the consensus that holds it as a masterpiece, there's still hope for it to remain interesting. But I don't think objectivity is helpful. I mean, I certainly think I'm right, you know, most of the time, and would argue strongly against people who I think are wrong. But at the end of the day, it's a matter of how well I've persuaded my readers, rather than how well I've upheld some kind of platonic or objective criteria.
Well, Carrie Rickey, my operative Paul Drake, has just informed me that you liked Hail Caesar, and so I now look forward to reading your piece on it too. Because I also
well, can I say something?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
I don't think it's an objectively good movie, but I enjoyed it.
Okay, talk about the difference between those two things.
I think that Hail Caesar probably requires a lot of knowledge of Hollywood movies and Hollywood production, and maybe in the late 40s and early 50s, and of the culture in the late 40s and early 50s. And I think if you don't have some of that knowledge, or most of that knowledge, you don't know what the F is going on. And it looks kind of silly. But I think it was, I liked much of it. And it made me laugh, and it kind of celebrated old modes of production, shall we say, musicals, aquatic movies, westerns, and it did it with a love affection and panache.
So one of the things that it has, and maybe it's one of the standards that critics do repeatedly apply, is self-consciousness. It's aware of what it's trying to do. It's not blundering around trying to do something that it doesn't even understand or having no purpose. That would seem to be something that would really militate against a critical appreciation. Michael Riedel, I want to sort of, since we opened this segment with Sondheim, you know, I think he's an interesting case, too, because here's a guy who, in a lot of his work, I mean, never so obviously as in that little clip from Sunday in the Park, but in a lot of his work, you can hear him talking back to people who appraise him, whether those people are critics, whether those people are fans, whether those people are producers early in his career who might have not produced his work because it didn't have a hummable melody. There is the question that, he embodies that artistic question. Who am I making this work for? Do I want to make Funny Girl and people would really like Funny Girl, you know? Or do I want to make something that rises to the level of my own critical sense of what I should do and risk the possibility that people won't like it?
Well, far be it for me to put any words in Steve Sondheim's mouth or any artist's mouth, but I don't think in my conversations over the years with composers and lyricists and playwrights, I really don't think they calculate it that way. I think an artist does what an artist wants to do. The artist is engaged by a particular subject matter, and he writes it in the only way that he knows how to write it. In the case of Steve, who was tutored by Oscar Hammerstein, came up in the tradition of the golden age of the American musical, and indeed his early ones were part of that golden age. And the last one he wrote really was A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which is a very funny traditional American musical comedy. But he was young, and I think he felt, I understand this form now, and now within it I can change it and play around with it and do something else. And then he does Anyone Can Whistle, which was a catastrophe on Broadway, but an interesting show in his development. And then he moves into things like Company and Follies that many critics, including Clive Barnes then at the New York Times, did not care for very much. They appreciated it, but they couldn't embrace it in Clive's case. Some critics loved it. The problem for Steve, and it was something that I think dogged him throughout much of his career, was that the audiences did not embrace what he was doing. Because when you tell the audience in 1971 you're doing a musical called Follies, they expect to get a Ziegfeldian-type Follies. And he gave them a show about middle-aged people having emotional crises. And that's not what the audience expected. Now, the irony, of course, is when Steve was shunned by those audiences, and indeed some critics back then, I would argue now that the slobbering over everything Steve does by the critics rubs me a little bit the wrong way. And indeed, my a brief and very superficial friendship with Steve ended several years ago when he came out with a musical. It was originally called Wise Guys, and then it became Gold. And because Steve was now the god of the American musical theater, he and the director of the show, Hal Prince, another god of the American musical theater, went to the powerful critics and said, we're going to take the show out of town, but please don't review it. Mm-hmm. And all of those major critics said, okay, because you are so important. And I said, no. This is a world premiere of a new Stephen Sondheim musical that reunites him with Hal Prince. They had not done a show for many years since Merrily We Roll Along. It was not announced it was coming to Broadway. It was at the Goodman Theater. And from my point of view, as a journalist, as a reporter whose responsibility is to my newspaper and my readers, not to Steve and not to Hal, I had to say, no, I'm sorry. I'm going to come and write about your show. And you know what? It wasn't very good. And that's the last time I ever spoke to Steve Sondheim.
But, you know, Tony Scott, let's go back to the beginning of what Michael is saying. Because it could be argued that if critics have a job, one of their jobs would be to see early on rather than too late what Stephen Sondheim is doing, ways in which he might be fracturing our understanding of the Broadway melody, that the purpose of Clement Greenberg is to tell us why Barnett Newman is worth looking at in a museum, and that if audiences don't get Barnett Newman, if audiences don't get Stephen Sondheim, and if critics haven't done a very good job of explaining why that is and maybe bringing audiences along with them, that's a fundamental failure of whatever it is that critics do. How do you react to that?
Well, I think that one of the things that critics do, not necessarily as an ideal part of the job description, but as a matter of fact, is to get things terribly, terribly wrong, and to often represent the worst of the conventional wisdom. And I'm saying this, you know, not just in accusation against other critics, but I kind of, you know, you're a creature of your own time and place, and you absorb a lot of the prejudices of that time and place, and you hope that you will be able to embrace the new, to see the new, to catch the signals from the future that forward-looking art can bring. And certainly I agree with my great fictional role model Anton Ego from the movie Ratatouille, that, you know, that the new needs friends, and that the one very useful thing that critics can do is to champion the new. But it's also true in the larger historical sense that the blindness or myopia or short-sightedness of critics is very important. I mean, my great predecessor at the New York Times, Bosley Crowther, was for many years a kind of embodiment of a conventional wisdom, of a sort of middle-brow kind of what people thought of the New York Times, and you know, was very dismissive of Bonnie and Clyde. And his dismissal of Bonnie and Clyde was one of the things that enabled people like Roger Ebert and Pauline Kael, a new generation of critics who saw something there that he couldn't, to articulate what it was that they saw. And his role at the New York Times was also to be a kind of a foil and a lightning rod for the more adventurous critics who were writing in the early 60s and late 50s at the Village Voice, people like Jonas Mekas and Andrew Saras. So there's not any one way to do it. I mean, I certainly like to think that I can spot what is promising and new, what is breaking the forms and the patterns and the conventions. But it may turn out to be the case that you know, 30 or 40 years from now, when the Museum of Modern Art is showing a retrospective on the later films of Adam Sandler, and with particular attention to Jack and Jill and Blended as the world changing masterpieces that they will have been discovered to be, that I'll be held up for ridicule for not seeing how brilliant they were.
Oh, they'll be outside.
Or when the Berlin Opera House does Julie Taymor's Spider-Man, I will be shown up and totally wrong about my judgment about that show.
That's right. In either case, your statues will be pulled down at some point. All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more of our critics after this.
These announcements are a pithy and droll satire on contemporary mores. I thought the part of the announcer was played with verve and gusto. These reviews go so much better when you write them yourself. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kion Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Stephanie Reif and Ross Levin. The part of Bill Curry was poorly acted by Nicolas Cage. For show pages, articles, and withering reviews of the Here and Now staff, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, the nose goes to New Haven for the Oscars. And now, back to Colin.
Oh, man. You made friends with him. See, friendship is the booze they feed you. As they want you to get drunk and feeling like you belong.
Well, it was fun.
Because they make you feel cool. And hey, I met you. You are not cool.
I know. Even when I thought I was, I knew I wasn't.
Right, because we are uncool. Now, while women will always be a problem for guys like us, most of the great art in the world is about that very problem. Hey, good-looking people, they got no spine. Their art never lasts. And they get the girls. But we're smarter.
Yeah, I can really see that now.
Yeah, because great art is about, you know, guilt and longing and, you know, love disguised as sex and sex disguised as love. Hey, let's face it. You got a big head start.
I'm glad you were home.
I'm always home. I'm uncool.
Me too.
You're doing great. Yeah.
The only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone else when you're uncool.
Is that my advice to you? And I know you think these guys are your friends.
If you want to be a true friend to them, be honest and unmerciful.
All right, that's Philip Seymour Hoffman, of course, as the great actual critic, Lister Banks, talking on the phone to the young rock and roll writer in Almost Famous, one of the great it's almost a soliloquy about criticism and about distance and detachment and being uncool and being the outsider. But there's so much more in there, too. And we're talking right now to A.O. Scott. His new book about criticism is called Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. Of course, he reviews film for the New York Times. Michael Riddell is theater columnist for the New York Post. His new book is Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway. Kerry Rickey, film critic, writer, former film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, is joining us by phone as well. So there are worlds and universes inside that clip. And I want to go to a slightly different place from where the clip goes, Kerry, although it's in there too. So one mode that critics sometimes get into, Tony talked in the previous segment, he used the term middlebrow. Well, middlebrow is, very much the creation of people like Dwight MacDonald and Russell Lines, who were essentially arguing there's something wrong with the culture itself, right? That it's not necessarily the art. It's not Norman Rockwell's fault that people think people like him better than Mondrian. It's the problems with the people itself, the audience itself. Vincent Canby, wrote about slob comedies. I mean, he didn't make much of a differentiation, I think, between Animal House and a really bad Adam Sandler movie. But there was something wrong with the culture. But Kerry, I guess I'm wondering, is that the critic's job to say there's something, it's not just the people creating stuff to be consumed, it's the process of consumption? And I'm not hearing Kerry. So Tony, you get to take that one instead. what about criticizing the whole audience?
Yeah, you want to become a scold there, Tony. That's what your readers want you to scold them.
Well, there is certainly a tradition of that. I mean, the great, highly idiosyncratic film critic Manny Farber wrote a whole column once called "Blame the Audience," where you want to know why the movies are so terrible. It's the audience's fault. They're suckers for vulgarity and sentimentality and all of this. I think it's much more complicated than that. I think, in fact, in the case of Norman Rockwell, subsequent generations of critics have come along and seen great value in his work. And I think there's always a problem for me with those kind of a priori categorizations and hierarchies. Something is low, something is high, something is sophisticated, something is coarse or vulgar. Those, it seems to me, have much more to do with social hierarchies, with ideas about class and culture than they do with art. And I think that a lot of works of art, both popular and more refined or specialized, cut against those hierarchies, and I think that audiences should be encouraged to disobey them also. I think one of the dangers that always exists out there that kind of gets in the way, I think, of criticism and of a full appreciation of what's out there is this kind of tracking of tastes, so you go on Amazon or you go on Netflix and, these algorithms will tell you what kind of person they think you are. If you like this, you might also like that. People who bought this also bought that. And you can settle into a kind of comfort zone that when I think what maybe audiences should be doing, not to get too prescriptive about it, is being adventurous, is seeking out the stuff that maybe nobody is telling you you're going to like or that you don't expect to like. I think that it's very important for critics to encourage that also and not to kind of lock their readers or themselves or the works of art that we write about into these boxes, into these pre-made categories.
And Michael, just to give an example from New York theater, So this year I'm a subscriber to New York Theater Workshop because I really like it. And I think they do great stuff there. On the other hand, I think the first show of the season was called Finally Colette Richard. I don't know whether you, Michael, happened to see it. But it was obviously a very avant-garde piece, more experimental theater. I didn't really enjoy it. I just had driven in from Connecticut. I didn't really like it that much. But I will say, reading Hilton Alls later, who didn't like it that much either, but reading Hilton Alls, who at least attempted to put me in some kind of context or help me understand the play in some kind of context or where the avant-garde is headed right now or something like that. I was very appreciative of the work of a critic at that point saying, okay, well, maybe you didn't like it that much, but here's a bigger way to think about it. How do you react to that?
Yes, I think that's Hilton fulfilling the primary responsibility of a critic, which is to be an engaging writer and a thinker. And while you may not agree with the critic's particular judgment on the show, you might be engaged by his persuasive writing. Or, in the best case scenario, you may not like something, but then the critic presents it in a way that you had not thought of it before and opens up something in it that perhaps you didn't see. And that's just pure intellectual engagement. And I think that's what the best critics do. But, you know, I don't think critics, if they attack the audience, if they take, I think it was Mencken who coined people, the bourgeoisie. If you call your readers the bourgeoisie, you're going to start annoying them and you're not going to have many readers. It's not a good thing for a critic to hold his nose up at the audience.
You know, Tony, there's two kinds of really famous reviews that people talk about forever afterwards. One of them, I mean, look, probably the most talked about review of any kind in the last 3 or 4 years was, of all things, Pete Wells reviewing a Guy Fieri restaurant doing it so viciously that everybody, you know, sent it around and repeated it. But there's another kind of review that people talk about and come back to. And the one that I'm going to use as an example now is 1974. John Landau saying, I just saw the Rock and Roll Past flash before my eyes, and I saw something else. I saw Rock and Roll Future, and its name is Bruce Springsteen. And people still quote that review. People still talk about it. But it's the critic doing this job of saying, you know what? Things are about to change right now, and everything that you take for granted is about to change. And this is something you address in your book, that this is one of the jobs of the critic, to say, all right, yeah, there have been all these other things that were really great. Forget about those for a second. Listen to this.
And you know, John Landau, in writing that, was putting down a huge marker because we remember that because it came true, you know, because we now know who Bruce Springsteen is and he's had, you know, 40 years since then to make good on that claim. It's very easy to imagine it going another way. I mean, there are plenty of cases, I think, probably, you know, in my own career, I can think of times when I've said, you know, stop everything, go out, see this movie. This movie is going to change everything about movies. And then, you know, crickets or people go and they're like, yeah, it was OK, but wow. You know, so you're risking something, but it's good to risk something. I mean, unlike what Michael Keaton is saying in that silly scene from Birdman, we are risking something. And I think when you put yourself out there like that, when you say, look, this really is extraordinary to me. When you're giving voice to your enthusiasm, you are making yourself vulnerable in a way. I mean, you can look very silly, and you're also unlike when you're writing a negative review and you're in a position of mastery. You know, when you're obviously superior to the thing that you're writing about, and so you can put it down in all of these witty and satisfying ways. When you're praising something, you're kind of in a posture of submission. You're kind of, you know, in awe of this thing, and you have to try to write as well and as cogently and with as much intelligence in that case as when you're knocking it down.
And I think, Tony, I mean, one of the pleasures of this job is to go to the screening room, or in my case, go to the theater, and be knocked out by something that's
absolutely
thrilling and exciting.
And we do have to stop right there. Michael Riedel, thank you so much. His book is Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway. Tony Scott, thank you. The book is Better Living Through Criticism. I feel so much better. I wrote the same John Landau review, but it was about Seals and Crofts. Well, you know, I don't know. They sounded really good at the time. We'll be back tomorrow with The Nose from The Study in New Haven. Come on and join us. It's a live audience, 1 o'clock, The Study on Chapel Street in New Haven. We'd love to see you there.
If you're noted by the author as you're making your way out, he reckons you're a talent, he's Semitic. I'd rather be a writer than a critic.
Those windows look ridiculous. Oh, and those doors? Lame.
Kyone, what are you doing to that old building?
I'm taking it down.
By yelling at it?
Well, what do you expect? It's destructive criticism.